It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's time for today's Lucky Land horoscope with Victoria Cash.
Life's gotten mundane, so shake up the daily routine and be adventurous with a trip to Lucky Land. You know what they say, your chance to win starts with a spin. So go to LuckyLandSlots.com to play over 100 social casino-style games for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Get lucky today at LuckyLandSlots.com.
Available to players in the U.S., excluding Washington and Michigan. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello, this is Dave Hendon with the Snooker Scene Podcast. This week, something a little different. There's a new film out this week called Break, and as the title suggests, it is set in the snooker world. And I watched it last week. Now, I believe reviews are actually embargoed until the end of the week, so I'm not going to say what I think, but thankfully, we do have the writer and director, Michael Elkin, with us, who can tell us all about the film. Michael, firstly, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, David. Nice to talk to you.
Okay, so before we get into the film, just tell us about your background, because I believe you're primarily an actor, but you've also obviously written and directed this film.
That's correct. Yeah, I started in this industry quite late, about 27, 28 years of age, after doing lots of different jobs, to be honest with you. I've worked on building sites, labouring. I've worked on the doors of casinos in central London. I'm a big fan of horse racing. So I did spend a couple of years just going up and down the country, putting bets on horses and sustained myself for a couple of years. Eventually, the money ran dry on that, as you probably imagine. So I just tried to work as an actor, which is something I'd always wanted to do. With mixed success, you know, I've appeared in a few films, a couple of soaps, EastEnders I was in a few times, but only minor, like an episode here and there. And then I'd always been a keen storyteller and started to write stories, which is how the thing with Break came. That was one of the first, probably not the first that I've written, but it's the first that I've gone on to direct.
Okay, so tell us about the film. It's called Break. There's a clue as to the subject matter, but as we were just chatting before we started recording, it's not necessarily a film about snooker, is it? But there is snooker in it.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, it's a film primarily about somebody triumphing against the odds, really. It's your famous old tale of rags to riches. Somebody who against the odds triumphs with you know, from a poor, impoverished background, if you like. Somebody that's born on a council estate. It kind of mirrors my own life in as much as I found acting. And although I used to play snooker, I wasn't ever really a talented snooker player. I think my highest break back then was 52. But recently I've actually upped that to 67, which I was over the moon with. So the guy's a talented player. He's surrounded by a lot of stuff that we find very current in today's society, like drugs and knife crime, you know, a lot of the stuff that the youngsters are sadly getting involved with. And I always had this thing that it, for me, it doesn't matter where you're from, what part of the tracks you're from, you know, you can always make something of your life. And that's kind of what Break is. It's about this guy's journey of trying to make use of the talents that he's got. And this happens with the aid of a mentor, a character played by David Yip called Vincent Kiang, or Chang, actually it's pronounced. And it's basically his journey. I think the best way to describe it is Karate Kid with a snooker cue. So although Karate Kid was primarily about, obviously, his journey as a karate student, with Break, it's not really, as you say, a snooker film, but it snooker happens to be the backdrop. It happens to be this guy's, potentially this guy's way out of his situation if he chooses to, you know, use the talents that he's got.
Yeah, I mean, you referenced the Karate Kid there, and the film I thought about, I think people always think about in terms of sports films, is Rocky, the sort of classic, you know, rags to riches and finding an outlet. But I guess the question is, why was it, in the case of this film, why did you choose snooker as the way that he could sort of improve his life?
Well, I'd always as a youngster, I grew up using a lot of snooker halls. I mean, I think Jimmy White's one of the most famous that said he used to skip school all the time and spend all his time around Mitcham in snooker halls. And I was the same with that as that for quite a while. A few of my friends, we used to skip school and we'd end up in either Tulse Hill, West Norwood or Brixton Snooker Halls, which is where I grew up, Crystal Palace. We had several. They've all sadly closed down now, which is a shame, I think, because grassroots is where snooker as a sport, I think, under Barry Hearn is going in a fantastic direction. But I think in grassroots, i.e. people walking to clubs, it's sort of suffered. But I was talking to a friend of mine about a player we knew that used to play in one of the clubs we used to go to, and he was an absolutely tremendous player. Rumour had it that he actually played, I think it was Jimmy White, and beat him. And everybody used to talk to this guy and go, why don't you turn pro? You know, why don't you go for it? But he was too busy being up to no good for the back drive, and, you know, and it just always puzzled me how somebody with a talent would choose to do that. I know it's quite often the excuse people use when they come from certain backgrounds that, you know, they had to choose a lot. Personally, I don't. I think with all options, but this guy in particular had an option where he could have pursued a career in snooker because he was that good, but never did. And I think that's where the story started, with the seed of this guy. It started with an image in my head that we had this guy with a snooker cue in a dimly lit, you know, snooker room, surrounded by gangsters. Because a lot of these places years ago, a lot of the snooker halls I used to go to, certainly, it was a hive of activity and characters. You'd have people sitting playing cards all day, and piles of money on the table, gambling going on. And it was just an array of characters. And I had this image of this guy standing there brandishing a snooker cue, which was ultimately his salvation, but branding it as a weapon, so ultimately using it wrong. And that was something that interested me. And I thought, what if we had this kid that, for whatever reason, didn't pursue his dreams, or he was dragged back into a life of crime, but he had this talent? And snooker just seemed like a nice way to get into some of the clubs, because I've always found them nice environments, despite, I've said, with all the characters, there wasn't really any trouble winning there. Just a good array of characters. And you always had these talented kids that came in that could play snooker. And some of them make it, some don't, which I think is par for the course in any sport, or indeed in any career that somebody chooses.
Yeah, Spencer Pride is the name of the main character, and it's fair to say his life, you know, there's a lot of problems. When the film starts, his father's in prison. Very early in the film, something pretty tragic happens to one of his friends. He's, as you say, he's you know, involved in drug dealing and a life that, you know, is probably going to follow his father into prison if he carries on the way he's going. It's fair to say, though, he has to be sort of talked into following his snooker path, doesn't he? It's not something that, even though he's talented at, he's necessarily seeing as a career at the start of the film.
No, he isn't. I think it's a dream that he's long lost. And I think sometimes the early parts of your life can be, it's only my belief, but I think a lot of the time, even as kids, a certain thing can happen in your life where you see that as a career option. You might not necessarily know it, or you'll expose a talent that you have very early on in life. Quite often, you don't get the opportunity to utilise that talent as you go on in life. You know, it gets forgotten, or you end up doing something else. I mean, how many times have you stood in a pub and someone said, I wish I'd have done that? And that's kind of me with acting. For years, I'd always wanted to do it, and it wasn't until 27, 28 years of age that I actually embarked, you know, on a career as trying to become an actor. And it's something I'd always wanted to do, but I didn't think that someone from my background could do that. I didn't know how to get into it. And it was a chance meeting with another actor, a guy named Jeff Bell, that was in films like The Business. And he's done lots of films now. He's actually got a good career. I was chatting to him one day and he said, well, go and do it. And I did. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people ignore that. And lots of people standing up wishing they'd done something. And I think that's kind of what I wanted to do with Spencer Pride. His character had this talent, but didn't necessarily want to utilize, didn't want to push forward with it for whatever reason. There's all sorts of reasons that people, you know, hold back. It's for fear of failure. You know, some people just don't like the thought of maybe trying it and then failing and having people laugh at them, which is something for me, even as an actor, that I started out and people were, you know, you'd get jokes and stuff with friends, and if you tell them you've got a great audition coming up, or there's a possible film part, and when you don't get that film part, you suddenly feel a bit like an idiot, that you've got to go back to them and say, no, I didn't get it. And quite often you do get ridiculed for that. So I think there's a point where with some people, they don't follow their dreams because they worry about what will other people will say if they don't, you know, if they don't achieve them. So yeah. It's a manner of reasons. And I think in Spencer's case, a lot of that was peer pressure from his friends. Also, that whole Well, you've seen the film, as you say, but the whole the backdrop of it, i.e. the troubles that he has that gets him into maybe just dragging backwards out of that life that he could achieve. So there was all manner of obstacles for this kid.
Yeah, and he's in pretty much every scene virtually. So obviously casting the character Spencer was very important. I was very impressed with Sam Gittins, who plays him. How did you sort of come to cast him? Did you know him beforehand, or was he auditioned?
I did know him beforehand, to be honest. Sam was actually one of the first people I attached to the role. I was doing some, you know, I said I've done building work. I was doing some work in painting and stuff in an office years ago in a call centre. And a lot of out-of-work actors used to work there. And Sam was one of them. And I got chatting to him one day, and it turned out we were from the same area. He used to box for Eltham Boxing Club, and he was actually a very good amateur, Sam. And we got chatting. As I was talking to him, I basically just popped into my head, because I'd written this script in about 2010, and it sat in a drawer for years. And when I saw Sam, I said, you know what? So I've just written something. You'd be perfect for it. He had the right amount. I mean, you've seen it, so, and it's good of you to say that he was good in it, because I honestly think he really, for a young actor coming out, he really carries this film. And does a fantastic job. And he had the right amount of vulnerability, the right amount of cockiness, and was also very rough around the edges. So it was a nice balance for me. So he was the first person that I attached before anybody else, before we even had producers. And I'd sent him a script, he'd agreed to do it, and then was the long journey of trying to get it financed. And a lot of people actually were running the film down, saying, who wants to see a film about snooker? It's really frustrating for me, you know. It's like, I mean, I think of films like The Colour of Money, which I know was Paul, but it's a big sports, and it's, you know, you don't have to like Paul to be a fan of Martin Scorsese's The Colour of Money. It's a great film in its own right, and that's kind of what I wanted to do with this. And I think people were, a lot of people that maybe don't follow snooker were blinkered, but it's true what you say. This isn't just a, you know, a snooker film. Snooker's the backdrop, so hopefully we'll have fans, you know, from the snooker scene. And hopefully fans, just everyday people that maybe wouldn't ordinarily engage with snooker, that will watch the film and go, actually, do you know what? I wouldn't mind picking up a cue and popping down the local snooker or having a few friends, because it's a great way to spend an afternoon and an evening. I used to love it.
Yeah, but you did, of course, you mentioned Sam obviously is the main actor in it, but excitingly, you got to work with a few snooker players as well. There are a few cameos in this. We've got Jack Lazowski, Liang Wenbo, who seemed to really enjoy himself, actually, and Ken Doherty as well. What was it like working with them, and how did you come to sort of put them in the film?
It was absolutely brilliant. You know what, when I first, I tweeted about this film years ago. I was working on the premise that if you build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. So I started tweeting about Break, going, new film coming soon, and I'd knocked up a poster, and I made it look like the film was actually happening. And Ken tweeted and went, this looks good, let me know and I'll do a cameo. But I think he said it as a joke. I screenshotted the tweet, and about 3 years later, when we were looking like we were going, I sent him a screenshot of his tweet via Twitter and said, Ken, we're ready to go soon, I'm going to hold you to that cameo. And he messaged back and went, yeah, sure. He said, here's my number or my contact details. So he was the first one attached, and we shot, before we did the main body of the shoot, we shot at the Crucible, which we can go into in a minute how we got to be there if you want to, but for now we got Ken. So he was the first one, and then we started looking at other players we could attach, and I think the producer, Dean Fisher, Fung, who looks after, amongst others, Judd Trump, Lucas Brazil, Jack Lasowski, Ollie Lyons. He's got quite a few. And we spoke to him, and we said, you know, we'd like to get Liang in there. And then also we said, maybe another one, let's have Jack as well. But Liang, as you mentioned in particular, I think really did enjoy it, because I've got some fantastic behind. I don't know if we captured it on camera or if it was just real, because it was between actual shoot. But he had to say a line at the table, and for whatever reason, something made him laugh, and he was absolutely hysterical and laying on the floor, rolling around in fits of laughing. It was absolutely brilliant, because he's got quite a high-pitched voice as well. And when he was laughing, you could really, his laugh was just cutting through the room, and it was infectious. We was all laughing. But yeah, he did enjoy it, and I think Jack did as well. And I mean, you've seen it. I think they were all really good as well. I think they all did their parts really well.
Yeah, and I think I'm right in saying as well, they also helped out, obviously, with the snooker sequences. You can't expect all the actors to be great snooker players. So the players, I guess, doubled at times in terms of the actual snooker.
Yeah, they did. I mean, Jack was fantastic. We got him to clear the table in one scene. which we obviously shot in close up, as if our main actor, Sam Gittin, Spencer Pride, was playing the shots. And we also got Liang to play some at a separate location on a different day. Ken didn't actually get to plan his shots for us. But Jack was fantastic. And we've got some stuff behind the scenes as well, where we've got them doing a few trick shots. And Liang's one was fantastic. I don't know what you'd call a trick shot, but he basically spotted the white in the centre of the D and put the black directly opposite on the cushion, you know, at the bottom of the table. And from there, with a certain amount of, I suppose it would be bottom side spin, he potted it in the bottom left corner. Which was just, to say it over the, you know, how we're talking now, probably you probably can't appreciate it, but it was such a fantastic, and he did it first time. Did it three other times after, and it's just, you really see the golfing class that anyone who thinks they can play, when you get these guys into a room, you see, you know, how easy it is for them. I mean, I don't mean that as a dismissive. I know they practice and put a hell of a lot of time in. But it really is. It's fantastic to watch them. But I think, yeah, you're right about the snooker player with regards to Sam and the other players. They're actors, essentially. So you are going to probably get some snooker purists who go, oh, he's not holding the cue right. Oh, that's ridiculous. He's not very good. But they're actors. And if you'd have just gone for a snooker player, they couldn't carry the film in an acting sense. So it's okay for people to criticise, which we've already had a couple, actually, on the basis of the trailer saying, you know, he doesn't look like he can hold the cue. And, you know, how a professional would. And it's like, well, no, he's not a professional. He's an actor. You know, Tom Cruise is not really a fighter pilot. so I think people will have to get over that. But I think as a standalone film with a backdrop of snooker, I think it's a good film to watch. I really do, even though I've been involved in it. So I might be biased. But.
Well, you mentioned, Michael, of course, you say the Crucible, your film there, which I think gives it authenticity, obviously, because everyone knows that's the one venue everybody knows. So how did that happen? Because that's quite a prestigious thing. You didn't just film there. You filmed there before, I think, the World Championship final.
We did, just before Higgins and Mark Williams. It was amazing, to be honest with you. We couldn't believe it. It was a fantastic place to be in. It's so iconic. We contacted Ivan Hershowitz from Matchroom and Early Doors, and we ended up having a meeting with Barry Hearn, who was very supportive and said, yeah, you know what, you can have the you can, you know, Ivan facilitated a lot of it for us and said, you can shoot at the Crucible, but you have to be in and out. So we had a certain time slot, which put us up against it time wise. But I mean, as you say, it was wonderful to film there. It really was amazing. And it really does give the film a lot of authenticity to actually go into the Crucible and do that. So really, it was thanks to the guys at Matchroom who have been so supportive of this. All of them, you know, Ivan and Barry Hearn as well in particular, has been amazing. And I think that's when you approach people like that and you're doing a film about their sport, it can go, you know, one of two ways. They can show no interest and say, no, it's, you know, we're not interested in films. Or they can be supportive, which is what they've done, I think, which is amazing for us. It really is. And allow us to shoot there. It really does, I think, elevate the film in terms of, for a low-budget independent British film, to be able to shoot there, it just gives us some massive production values.
We should say as well, we've talked about the various players that are in it. There's a very, very well-known actor in this. Rutger Hauer is in it. Sadly, passed away last year. But how did you end up with him in the film? Because that's quite a coup.
It is, yeah. We were approaching, for his role, we approached quite a few big name actors in the early days, and we had another actor, it's pointless me mentioning now, but another big actor as well that said yes to the role. And then when we came round to finally finance, he was contracted elsewhere. So our casting director, Kate Plantin, put a breakdown out, and some of the agents come back with suggestions, and we were looking for all these, you know, good acting names. And all of a sudden, as we were flicking through the photos and the submissions, Rutger Hauer was there, and we all sort of looked at each other and went, really? Would he do this? And they said, well, he's you know, his agent's putting forward. Let's try it. So we basically called back and said, look, we'd love Rutger to do this. Do you think he'd be interested? And the first thing he said was, you know, Michael's a first-time director, which I am, and I'd need to see the script. So we sent in the script, and it came back after about a week that he'd read it. He liked it, and he was happy to do it, but he needed to talk to me. So I had to have several calls over the phone. I think it was either WhatsApp calls or Skype calls, but we were videoing anyway. So we were chatting to each other and just having a little bit of a chat about the script, with how what my vision of the film was and his role. And his back of a few ideas. It's a little while. But we went on so in the end, we'd have a call where we just chat about everyday life and laugh and joke. And then all of a sudden it came back round to it. And I said, Rucker, are you going to do this film or not? Because we seem to have gone off on a tangent chatting about other stuff. And he said, well, I don't know. Which was really frustrating. I thought we were getting somewhere. So I basically just put it on the spot. I said, Rucker, please, listen, I'm not going to ruin this film. You know, it will be a nice film to be involved in. Please just say yes. And he took a beat and then he just, yeah, OK, I'll do it. And it was as simple as that. He agreed and that was it. I put the phone down. I think I was on cloud nine after putting the phone down. I couldn't believe me luck.
Well, I was going to say, for your first film, you know, to get someone like that, if you've grown up watching Blade Runner and all the rest, that's quite something. I mean, I guess that must have persuaded you, right, I've really got to make sure I do this well, because we've now got a serious name attached to it.
Yeah, it does. It certainly does add a little bit of pressure. It really does. But then, to be honest, I think because it had been such a passion project, I mean, from the time I wrote it, it's taken over 10 years I've had it, you know, and I wasn't pushing that whole time, admittedly, for quite a long time. It was just sat in a drawer. But it certainly, from when I started to push it out there, it took about 5-6 years to actually get made, to get the money and then to get done. So I think the pressure was on me anyway, after all that time to not mess it up. I mean, obviously people are making their own opinions up when they see the film, but I don't think I have. I'm pleased with it. I think anyone who says they're completely happy and anything's perfect would be lying. So there would certainly be, with money permitting, time permitting, and with hindsight, that there'd be things that I might change or tweak. But overall, I'm very happy with it. And I think, yeah, the pressure was there certainly with regards to the whole thing. But I
just lost you briefly, Michael. I hope you can still hear me.
Yes, Dan, that's fine.
All right. Now, I should explain that I'm at the World Championship qualifiers, which start tomorrow, and I'm in a hotel, and the Wi-Fi is not great, but I think we just got that. I was going to ask, I mean, you're first-time director. Obviously, you come from an acting background. The process of getting a film made, I think, to the outside world is quite mysterious. Maybe most people don't even think about how films get made. But obviously, you need a lot of people. You need money to put it all together. Where do you even start? Okay, you've written the script. Where do you go with it? And how do you end up with a film that's actually finished?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And I think to this day, David, I'm not sure I even know how we got here, to be honest with you. But basically, as I say, I put it out there that this was happening. And one of the other people I approached later on was an actress called Terry Dwyer, who many people might know from Hollyoaks. She used to do 60 Minute Makeover as well, so she crossed into presenting. But I read on her tweets that she was looking to get back into acting. So I started looking back and thinking about it. So I searched a few of her roles on YouTube again, and just to refresh myself. I knew who she was. I was well aware of who she was. And then I thought, actually, she'd be really good playing Spencer Pryde's mum. So I approached her and said, do you want to read the script? I've got a role you might be interested in. Anyway, cut a long story short, she was interested. We met in London to talk about the film, and she asked me, how much money have you got to make this film, and when are we starting? To which I replied, well, I've got absolutely no money, no producers, I've got nothing. I've just got you and a couple of actors attached. So then I asked her, would you be happy to produce it? I said, you probably know a lot more people it on that side of things than I do. And she luckily agreed. And then she introduced me to Dean Fisher, who's another producer that she'd worked with in the past. And it really started from there. I mean, I'd approached a couple of financiers before I even approached them, but a lot of them were telling me to get rid of Sam Gittins and saying, you know, get a named actor. I think Taron Egerton's name was bandied about a few times. And I was always of the opinion that if you're going to, you know, start a film like this, why not give a young up-and-coming actor a chance? Because people didn't want to give me a chance. A few people said to me, I can produce this film for you, I can get the money, but you can't direct it. Because no one knows you as a director. So I think I had to get quite precious then and quite tight with it and say, no, I'm not letting go of the script, because it will descend into something I don't want, which is, it could have ended up being a shout. It's like a, no disrespect, but like a soap opera, like an EastEnders type of shout. Mm. Each other, and you know, a working class Cockney sort of drama, which I didn't want. And I could see that if it was out of my hands, I couldn't control that. I wanted to make something, well, close to what I've made. So I think that was the process. Then we eventually we found a broker who basically finds money for people. They charge percentage for their, you know, for their outlay because it costs them to put breakdowns out and to try and people in. And we basically use them to source money. We use some private equity investors of our own that we met and put in the, you know, bulletins out and to investors. And once you start to get a bit of money, you have to keep making videos, making appeals to people and saying, look, we're trying to make this film. We've got this name attached. Once we got Rutger Hauer, we were about two thirds, I think, and it had taken us about 6 months to get that. Once we started going out to financiers, once we got Rutger, I think the rest of the money all came within about a month. So having him on board certainly adds a lot of credibility to the project.
Which is all great, and you've got it made. But, of course, the problem is it's coming out at a time where cinemas are essentially closed. We know the reasons why, all the lockdown and everything. I think they are sort of opening up soon, but it's obviously a very difficult time for cinemas. So how are people actually going to get the chance to see the film?
Well, we've actually, on the 22nd, which is in 2 days' time of this month, we're actually holding a drive-in cinema event at the Brent Cross Shopping Centre. Tickets are available on our website at breakfilms.co.uk, and you can just sign up, register for a ticket, and the tickets are actually free. So people can just come down in their car, one, two, three, four of them in a car if they want to. Tickets are free. There will be a red carpet. There will be press covering it. We've got, I believe, ITV coming down, Sky, I think, are coming down, and we've got some people from Good Morning Britain as well covering the event. So there will be a host of a few familiar names from TV, film and music as well in attendance. So people will be able to see the red carpet interviews and then after watch the film. And after that, we've got a DJ plan as well. So we're trying to make the best of the, as you say, the COVID-19 situation and make it a nice, fun event for people to come down and view the film. It is unfortunate that cinemas are not open. But there really isn't a lot we can do about that, so we've just had to go with what we can. And I think it should be a fun evening, as long as we get the weather, which we look like might be fixed. So they can see it there. The film is then released digitally and DVD on the 31st of August. But I think you can actually pre-order DVDs now. I think it's up on HMV and different sites, Apple, iTunes. We'll be out then as well. But we hope after this we're actually going to Sheffield. And the film will be, again, a drive-in at the Don Valley.
Right.
And that will be on the 1st and 2nd of August, so still during the tournament. And in the evening, hopefully, we'll be able to hook up with a few of the snooker players afterwards. Maybe at a bar somewhere, let's see.
Brilliant. And has this experience of making this film persuaded you want to do another one? Or because you've sort of shifted from acting to directing, is that something you want to do more of now?
Yeah, definitely. I think I still love acting. I'll still take roles if they come up, but it's not something I'm pushing for as much as I used to. I think for me now, I have fallen in love with not just the directing, but the writing side of things. I really like, the script process, coming up with ideas. And I've actually got two or three projects that are pretty much finished at the moment that I'm going to start pitching to people and try to get out there and try and get some financiers and also TV companies interested, because one of them's a series, an ongoing series. Much in the vein of, say, an English sort of Sopranos. I think definitely I will be pushing to write and direct more stuff now. It was a hard task, and it's certainly not for the faint-hearted. It was a big problems coming. We had lots of hurdles, lots of things to overcome. And then, as you've mentioned, we had a pandemic thrown at us as well just before we were about to release and have a West End premiere. It's certainly been a testing time. But it hasn't put me off. There will be hopefully more from me once this comes out. Hopefully people will give me another chance to do some more stuff and put their faith in me.
Good. Well, just give us the website again, Michael, so people can go there if they want tickets.
Okay, so www.breakfilms.co.uk. And if you go on there, there's a link to register, which you'll have to do through Eventbrite. And you just register for a ticket. If there's just one car coming, even if there's four of you in there, just register for one ticket and the four of you come in one car. Obviously, if there's eight of you coming and you're bringing two cars, then register for two tickets. But the tickets are free. They are running out fast. But if people want to come and see the film, there is still time to grab a ticket and there's still some left.
Excellent. Well, just to say, I think our chat did cut out a couple of times just because of the Wi-Fi, but hopefully 99% of it will go through. Michael, thanks for joining us on the podcast and I wish you all the best for your film.
Thank you, David. Great to talk to you.
Thanks. Sports Social Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.